Hello, my name's Steve Chu. I'm the designee for the Secretary of Energy, nominee by President-elect Obama. And I'm delighted to be here to talk about a couple of subjects that I care deeply about. And so let me just begin. I've been asked to comment on the U.S. and climate stabilization. And in the comment, it was a comment that says we have to press very hard to keep the average temperature of the world below a rise of 2 degrees centigrade. I think this is an essential goal. It'll be a challenge as to whether we can actually keep it to 2 degrees centigrade, but we simply do not know what will be happening if we go to higher temperature, average temperatures in the globe, 4, 5, 6 degrees. Based on what we know before, if you compare the temperature we are at today in the world to the temperature of the ice ages, it was only about 6 degrees centigrade colder. And we know that the ice ages where Pennsylvania, Ohio were covered in a permanent glacier and New York City in a permanent glacier, that was a very, very different world than where we are today. So it doesn't really take that much imagination to at least realize that if we go 6 degrees warmer, it will be a very different world, and a world where it would be, quite frankly, in my mind, very hard to adapt. So there's other issues. We don't know about the certain tipping points. Let me describe one of the tipping points. There's a tremendous amount of carbon in the frozen tundra in Russia, in Canada, and other places. As the Earth warms up, the microbes in that tundra will begin to wake up. And they will begin to chew on this carbon in the form of dead vegetation and reprocess it in the form of carbon dioxide and methane. Once they begin to do that, scientists say that there will be a release of greenhouse gases that will actually create a runaway effect. And by that I mean that they begin to release more carbon dioxide and methane, it goes up into the atmosphere, there's more greenhouse gases that warms the Earth up still more, and it creates a runaway effect, so much so that there is a reasonable probability that once this starts, the amount of greenhouse gases released could then be larger than, it can even dwarf the amount of greenhouse gases that humans are putting in the air now. And at that point, it's completely out of our control in the sense that even if the humans stopped emitting more greenhouse gases, the release of the trapped carbon material in the tundra just runs away. We don't know exactly what temperature this is going to occur, but as we go to warmer and warmer temperatures, 4, 5, 6 degrees centigrade, many scientists are feeling that this may really kick in. We cannot go there. I think a world of the 1 degree rise in the temperature of the world is already written into the system. Even if humans don't emit any more, we're going to see a 1 degree centigrade rise on average. But and I agree completely, we have to do what we can to keep it to about 2 degrees or less. We're going to do more research and find out when this tipping point is, but the uncertainties are very large at this moment. It is certainly one of the main reasons why I took this job. In fact, the main reason why I started getting interested in the energy problem was because of climate change. And I share the concerns of many of the people who have commented on this. Looking at another comment, it was to implement a nationalized smart grid. I'd love to talk about this. I have been on a committee called America's Energy Future. It's a committee that the National Academy of Sciences and the National Academy of Engineering has put together. And I'm on the parent committee, but I've also put myself on the transmission and distribution subcommittee. This is a very important issue as America and the world transitions to more and more renewable energy. You need to be able to port energy from the areas of generation of this energy, for example, the great wind resources that are in North Dakota, South Dakota, Wyoming, and other states, we have to ship that energy to population centers in the United States. there are great solar resources in California, Arizona, Texas, New Mexico. Again, the good news is both the solar energy resources and the wind energy resources are in areas that are not very densely populated. And the bad news is they're not very densely populated, and so you have to move the energy to population centers. For that, we need a long-distance transmission system, specifically to take the energy from those places. But in addition to that, we need an overlay of the transmission and distribution systems in the United States. There are roughly a half a dozen regions in the United States where we distribute electricity, but as we go to more renewables, we have to start thinking in terms of a national distribution system, because these energy resources are in only certain areas of the United States. And this is actually somewhat different because in the past, historically, we generate electricity locally where we use it. And it's just like a highway system. In the early 1950s, President Eisenhower said we need a national highway system, in large part because of national defense. And where you had, let's say, a turnpike in New Jersey or a turnpike in New York State, but then as soon as you got out of the state's boundaries, it stopped. And we have to start thinking of a national distribution system so we can use these transient energy resources like wind and solar, photoelectric, solar thermal, geothermal, and distribute that around the country. There's another important reason why we need a transmission and distribution system that's modernized, and that is when a cloud rolls over, or the wind just stops blowing, or perhaps it changes its intensity, the electricity distribution system has to respond very quickly to these changes. And by that I mean it has to be able to switch in conventional baseload generation of electricity. The wider the distribution system, the better you can switch the generation of electricity around in all parts of the nation. And in fact, I don't think you have to be a rocket scientist to realize that if you could, in the best of all possible dreams, have a distribution system that circles the Earth, somewhere in the Earth the wind is blowing, the sun is shining. And the wider the distribution system, the more even these renewable energy sources look. If you're locating just a small area, then you're quite vulnerable to dark days and windless days and nights. So this is a very important aspect of it. It is a huge task. It will be costing hundreds of billions of dollars to somewhere close to $1 trillion. It has to be coordinated well. But it's very important that we move in this direction now as the renewable energies in the United States begin to grow. Another topic was whether we should develop a Manhattan-style project to push for energy independence. I'm very much in favor of this, but I have to say that's slightly different than a Manhattan-style in the sense that the Manhattan Project was a large project done in secret, secluded areas. Price was not large an object. This is a very different thing. The science and technology we need to develop to give us much better choices for energy has to be done in a very open way. Industry has to adopt it. And the best places for this are at universities, places like national laboratories, and the university and national lab research should be feeding into industry in an intimate way. I'm all for this. It is vitally important that we push very hard. And the reason fundamentally, and I'll be very brief on this, is that science and technology will give us much better options. Just as in the turn of the last century, from the 19th century to the 20th century, German scientists invented a way to make fertilizer. They invented a way to synthesize ammonia that can then be used to make artificial fertilizer. It was that invention that totally transformed the way Europe fed itself. And it was that invention that enabled the population to grow and we could feed ourselves for many, many years. Before that invention, Europe was thinking of actually importing soil from the New World or using their colonized areas to grow food for Europe because they were suffering a huge depleted soil problem. And with the invention of artificial fertilizer, all of a sudden, Europe could feed itself. I think on a very similar vein, a lot of the things we're looking in the energy challenge to combat, mitigate climate change, for energy security and independence, a transformative invention could really transform our worries and what we can and can't do. And as a scientist, I remain optimistic that the intellect of great scientists will enable us to provide, again, these wonderful discoveries and inventions. Now, but the last thing I want to comment on is encourage science and technology, and it feeds directly into this. It's very clear to me and to many other people who have thought about this that the key to America's prosperity in the 21st century is the development of its intellectual capital, particularly in science and technology. The example I gave about the invention of fertilizer, another example I can give is the Green Revolution, which occurred in the late 1960s, early 1970, in which a person by the name of Norman Borlaug was able to breed plants, a dwarf strain of wheat, that increased the productivity of wheat 4 to 5-fold per acre, not only in the United States, but in countries like Mexico, India, Pakistan. And that invention, again, prevented the mass starvation of hundreds of millions of people that others felt was imminent. Norman Borlaug got the Nobel Peace Prize for this discovery. This comes out of basic science. He was a plant breeder. And I think the science and technology that we can discover a new generation of photovoltaic cells, artificial photosynthesis so that you capture the sunlight, you use that energy to capture carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, combine it with water, and produce a hydrocarbon. So it's essentially an artificial plant, but something in the end that could be made much better. These are some of the things I think the science and technology can give us. But let me just say one last thing, and that is what is in the root of science is wanting to understand how the world around us works. And this is something that is really part of the human condition. How do you actually understand? Why is it that the sun is shining and the sky is blue and all these other basic questions? You know, the discovery of how the universe started and how it evolved, a deeper understanding of biology and the molecular dynamics of this biology are great intellectual triumphs. And it is really part of the human condition, as I said, that is another reason why we should be supporting science. But the reason why we should support it in a big way is the future of our economic prosperity. So I hope this has been useful to you. Thank you. And keep your comments and questions coming, and we will be glad to try to respond to them. Thank you, and goodbye.